President Obama's economic advisor Alan Krueger has studied the ways technology has transformed another key industry. Mr. Krueger, who will soon be leaving Washington, D.C. to return to his old job teaching economics at Princeton, took some ribbing from his boss this week.
And now that Alan has some free time, he can return to another burning passion of his, rockonomics. The economics of rock and roll. This is something that Alan actually cares about.
In fact, Mr. Krueger gave a speech this week at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, where he said the music business offers valuable lessons about the broader U.S. economy, and NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Krueger titled his speech Land of Hope and Dreams in honor of his fellow New Jersey native, Bruce Springsteen. Springsteen boasted the second-highest grossing concert tour last year, right behind Madonna, with 72 shows that together raked in more than $199 million. That makes The Boss a fitting emblem of our modern superstar economy. In music, as in so many industries, Krueger says, the lion's share of the money now goes to a relative handful of top performers.
The lucky and the talented, and it is often hard to tell the difference, have been doing better and better, while the vast majority has struggled to keep up.
Economists point to a variety of explanations for that growing concentration of income, technology, globalization, and Krueger highlights that role of luck, noting that for every superstar, there are other equally talented performers who don't catch the same breaks. He notes that Columbia Records almost passed on the hit single that Rolling Stone later called the greatest rock and roll song ever.
Like a Rolling Stone.
Lucky for us, Bob Dylan's six-minute opus was released, and thanks to modern recording technology, Dylan was able to reach a worldwide audience. More recently, of course, technology has upended the music business, depressing album sales so artists depend more on concerts to make money. Krueger says that's a big reason concert tickets have gotten more expensive. But as every good scalper knows, many artists still don't charge as much as they could for fear of breaking an implicit bargain with their fans.
Along these lines, Tom Petty once said, "I don't see how carving out the best seats and charging a lot more for them has anything to do with rock and roll."
And I won't back down.
Krueger says for much of the last century, the whole U.S. economy was governed by a similar social compact, the idea that economic gains should be widely shared. Krueger argues that was reinforced in the decades after World War II by a progressive tax system, labor unions, and a rising minimum wage.
Now, I'll argue that that social compact was good for business and it was good for the economy. But the social compact began to fray in the 1980s.
Since then, top earners have seen their income skyrocket, while the middle class has been treading water, and those at the bottom of the income ladder have actually fallen a few rungs. Not surprisingly, as an advisor in a Democratic White House, Krueger advocates policies designed to mitigate that trend. He says a stronger middle class would not only fuel more economic growth, but also promote more equal opportunity. Otherwise, the next Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, or Bruce Springsteen might never get his hands on a guitar.
Meet me in a land of hope and dreams.
Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. Mortgage rates are climbing, and economists are worried that could stifle the housing market recovery. This is the sixth week in a row that rates have risen. The average 30-year fixed-rate loan is near 4%, a big jump from the record lows that have prevailed in recent years. Here's NPR's Yuki Noguchi.
The Federal Reserve has two main missions: to maximize employment and keep inflation in check. Right now, there are few, if any, signs that prices are spiking, and the job market is still crawling out of its long, deep slump. The Fed tries to protect the nascent recovery by keeping interest rates low. One of the ways it does this is by buying massive amounts of treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. It has also reminded investors it will continue taking such steps until the jobless rate declines to 6.5%. But investors aren't heeding the Fed's assurances that, when the time comes, it will wind down its stimulus very slowly. Michael Fratantoni is vice president of research for the Mortgage Bankers Association.
I think we, along with many other forecasters, had anticipated that rates were going to rise this year, but had anticipated a gentle floating up of rates as opposed to a sudden jump like we've seen.
Fratantoni says refinancing activity last week declined 36% from the previous month, largely because most eligible homeowners already locked in record low rates near 3.5%.
Once rates are up close to 4% as they are now, you have a very large number of people that just have no incentive to refinance anymore.
Higher interest rates will affect how much homebuyers can borrow, but Guy Sakala, CEO of the trade publication Inside Mortgage Finance, says 4% is still well below the historic norms.
I don't think it'll have any negative effect on the housing market.
Sakala says investors buy into safe havens like treasury bonds when they fear the stock market or don't trust that the economy is stable. So the fact that demand for treasuries is down and that interest rates are rising is a sign of greater investor confidence.
It's a very positive sign. You know, if the price we pay for an improving economy and everything is 4% interest rates long term, so be it. That would be a great outcome.
The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee holds a meeting to discuss policy next week. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Every day there are families who struggle to make ends meet. On paper, many do earn enough to pay their bills, but they fall behind because of timing, like when the rent is due on the 10th and payday isn't until the 15th. There's a research project called U.S. Financial Diaries that's been tracking several hundred of these families. We're going to hear now about one solution that they found people turning to. Marianne McCune of Planet Money and WNYC reports on informal banking.
How informal? Meet Miguel Rada. He just spent 32 years in prison. He lives in a halfway house in West Harlem. He's on public assistance. He's also a banker.
One time, a guy came to me and he said, look, I got to do something over the weekend. I need $20.
People ask him for help a lot because Miguel Rada has a reputation for penny pinching. The man just took a personal finance course at a local credit union called Neighborhood Trust. To manage his money, he says he just asks himself,
what do I need for this week? Do I need car fare? No, my Metro card is still valid. So I'll put 10 away and I keep 20.
So if you need to travel to see your mom and you don't have money to get there, in Miguel Rada's pocket is a tiny bank. He's actually helping people do something economists call consumption smoothing, basically figuring out ways to pay for regular needs, even when income is erratic. A lot of people use credit cards or banks.
The people you're lending to, could they borrow from a credit card or a bank?
Some of their credit is so bad, you know, it would be virtually impossible.
His version of a credit check?
I might ask somebody, what's the problem? Is there a way out?
His ledger.
I keep it up here in my head.
He doesn't charge interest, and if somebody doesn't come back with his money, he says he doesn't bother them. But there are ramifications.
If you don't pay, it won't happen again.
For people who need help saving, here's a more surprising bankish thing Rada does. He accepts deposits, like from his much less frugal brother.
I say, yo, you want me to hold something for you? Yeah, man, hold this 100 for me.
The last time his brother came back for it,
I asked him, what's going on? You know, what do you need this for? And he told me, I got to take care of this bill. I got to do this. So, and I went with him.
And that is the kind of scenario that would make Tamara Bullock feel ill. She never borrows from family.
Because when you put family in, then they have the right to critique.
Bullock is in her tiny office at a Harlem funeral home. She's a single mom climbing her way out of a decade of debt. She has a different informal saving strategy. It's called a SUSU, a savings group. And the last one she was part of is pretty typical. 13 colleagues and friends promised to pitch in $100 every 2 weeks for a total of $1,300 each time. Every 2 weeks, somebody in the group gets the pot. Bullock says she loves SUSUs because they force you to save.
You have to. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts because other people are dependent on you to be accountable.
2 weeks ago, when her turn came to get the $1,300, she used it to pay a lump sum to a collection agency, which actually saved her money in the long run. She does have a savings account, too. But the SUSU, as someone who loves shopping a little too much,
I like that I can't access it.
As for what to do with her next payout, in the office next door, 62-year-old Patricia Hamilton says she wants to repeat an adventure they had together a while back.
She's going to skydive again. We're going to go swimming with the sharks also. She's going to skydive again.
Informal lending can be a great tool. But Rachel Schneider with the Center for Financial Services Innovation, that's one of the groups behind the Financial Diaries Project, she says there are some downsides.
A key issue is that with that form of lending, you don't necessarily build up a credit history. And yet the repayment behavior is just as good as if you had a credit card and your payments got reported to the credit bureau.
Schneider's group and others are taking note. At least one bank is trying to make people's unofficial good credit with friends and family count on their official credit history. And there's a lot of unofficial good credit out there. Remember that friend of Miguel Rada's, the guy who borrowed $20 for the weekend? He just needed to get to a job where he got paid.
Monday morning, he came to me and he says, "Here, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I needed it." I said, "No problem, man."
Come back again. Marianne McCune, NPR News, New York.
Okay, a summer job at a camp or an amusement park is a rite of passage for many young Americans. These jobs also appeal to young foreigners who come here on J-1 cultural exchange visas. Well, critics are now taking aim at these kinds of visas, saying that far too many young Americans are out of work these days. And so Congress is taking a closer look. From member station WSHU, Kaomi Goetz reports.
About a dozen teenagers gather under a pavilion one rainy afternoon at the Cowlick Ice Cream Shop in Hancock, New York. The village is in a rural area upstate, bordering the Catskill Mountains. Kelly Newman is an outgoing 18-year-old. This summer, she'll be working as a local swimming instructor, making minimum wage at $7.25 an hour. In this area, about one in five teenagers lives below the poverty line. She considers herself lucky to have a job. She knows there aren't a lot of options for high-paying work.
McDonald's, if you want to make more than minimum wage, you might as well just kind of forget it.
But there are jobs. Down the road is French Woods. It's a performing arts summer camp that attracts young people from around the world. About half of its 400 employees come from another country.
I'm from the UK, like a lot of the counselors here.
That's 19-year-old Joe Davis. It's his second summer at French Woods. He's handsome, polite, and works as a lifeguard.
I wanted to travel when I left education. I wasn't too sure on what I wanted to do, and at the time I didn't have much money to sort of go out and just work my way around the world, so I looked into the Camp America program.
Davis is one of more than 170,000 foreigners who are in the U.S. at any given time on a J-1 visa. The visa category was created decades ago to promote cultural exchange. Overseas applicants go through an American company that sponsors, screens, and places them in jobs. Most work as camp counselors, au pairs, or at an amusement park. Participants must return home afterwards. Beth Schaefer is part owner of the French Woods Camp. She says the foreign workers are not taking jobs away from Americans.
We hire a lot of American staff, but for us, we're able to have people who come in who are really engaged in a different sort of way.
The idea here is that foreigners bring a different cultural perspective. And unlike U.S. teens, they're motivated less by money and more by adventure, which can be a nice spirit to add to a camp. Last summer, Davis made only about $1,000 for 3 months' work. Still, he enjoyed the experience and shared his British perspective with American kids. But a provision in the immigration bill now being considered by Congress could change things. Bill Goetz is CEO of the American Institute of Foreign Study, the organization that sponsored Davis. Goetz says the proposed legislation could kill these J-1 exchange programs.
If these students do not come into this country, they'll be, this is the soft diplomacy that the U.S. really needs.
Still, critics say the J-1 program is not well regulated and can hurt U.S. job seekers. Back in Hancock, 17-year-old Joe Hanstein of nearby Lakewood, Pennsylvania, says the J-1 visa program should be in tune with the local economy.
I see the point of the program, but maybe since our unemployment rate's so high and people are always wanting jobs, they should sort of cut back on the foreigners for a while.
But for himself, Hanstein doesn't need minimum wage work at a camp or amusement park. He's got a leg up. His dad's excavation business is paying him $10 an hour this summer. For NPR News, I'm Kaomi Goetz.